Hi, Vanessa.
Hi, Dom.
We are on our, we're back to the Middle East now, and with our guest, Steve Cole, former Dean, Steve Cole, our Dean.
Forever
Dean. Steve Cole, we are here to talk about your upcoming book, which is going to be out in February, which is The Achilles Trap. We're just going to jump right into it because it's a tome of real journalism. So I want to...
That rare thing.
Listeners know how much I complain about the minimality of mediocre nonfiction in America. I don't want to call it journalism, but op-eds extended into 300 pages. This is the real stuff. Let's do the Jonah Goldberg thing. What's your story about, Steve?
So my story attempts to enlarge what we understand about the origins of the invasion of Iraq by including Saddam's perspective, his thinking, his actions. And the reason for doing that, apart from history being, you know, sort of complete, especially a war requires understanding how both sides came into conflict. But in this case, you know, a lot of our reflection in the U.S. And arguments about the Iraq war has focused, understandably, on the post-9/11 questions of selling the war on the basis of WMD that it turned out didn't exist, and how did that happen, and who was complicit, and so on. But you could ask that same question another way, and really hasn't been asked, which is, why did Saddam create the impression that he had WMD when he didn't? Because it ended up costing him his regime and his life. And it wasn't just the U.S. that believed he had it. I mean, even the Germans who were opposed to the war, they believed he had it. They just didn't think we should invade. And so how did this impression arise? And so it turns out that to answer that, you have to go way back into the history of the U.S. relationship with him. And that's what the book does.
Previously, to what extent had journalists been able to get into Saddam's mind? Like, how much could people really understand versus how much was like kind of locked away?
Yeah, I mean, most of it was locked away. I was a Washington Post reporter for many moons. And at one point after the invasion, about 6 months after the invasion, I went to Baghdad and I met some of the sort of CIA-sponsored investigators who were trying to figure out, where is all this WMD? It's supposed to be here. Where is it? And by the time I got there, they pretty much figured out it wasn't around. And so they were starting to interview Iraqi aides to Saddam, asking them, like, what happened? And I wrote some stories about it at the time and was just struck by how was it that he, sort of ended up creating this false impression. And there were some early theories that I wrote my stories about. Well, he was bluffing his neighbors. He wanted people to have the impression that he had weapons so that they wouldn't attack him. And I just was always curious about whether that was true or not. And so it turns out, and this is the real opportunity that led me to do the book, that actually, Saddam had tape-recorded his leadership conversations for decades, more assiduously than Richard Nixon did. And these materials have a strange history. We can get into it if you're interested. But bottom line, they're not available today. I worked with the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press to sue the Pentagon to get a big batch of them. And then through other methods, was able to access other parts of them. Some scholars have used them. But they're really unknown to the general public, and they're amazing.
And some
of the ones I got haven't been out before anywhere.
This is actually what I wanted to dig into. This is why I wanted to set up this book as the real thing in terms of journalism, because before we even start talking about the Middle East and what you study in the book, both in terms of the psychology of the parties involved and the game theoretical dynamics, just as an achievement of reporting and access, this is amazing. So if you can go into the details of what you were able to get your hands on, how, to the extent that you can share, but also why now? Like, what made now the opportune time to actually get all these threads together?
The how part, just I've been doing this work for a long time. I don't really know how to do anything else, and I don't have like a variety of methods. I just do the same thing every time. And one of the things I've learned, if I take on a really complicated, hard target, as they say, you know, I have to try everything, that there's no magic bullet. So I use all sourcing methodologies. I use interviews. I use Freedom of Information Act requests. In this case, I filed a lawsuit with an NGO as a partner. I go back into archives and dig around for material that isn't there. I vacuum up everything that is available, but often in obscure sort of scholarly areas. And I travel and I talk to people. So I just do it all. And eventually it starts out very confusing. Like, is there really a story here? And what is the story? And gradually, if you just stick with it, I'm the luxury of time. I'm very lucky in that way. And it starts to make sense. And I'm usually looking for people who can help carry the story for readers. So, you know, to humanize the story. And I have to discover those people by actually meeting them or encountering them in the story in some way. And so that all of that happened this time. Why now? I mean, partly I came out of a book project. I was looking for another book project. This question had been hanging in my brain for many years. And I was like, I wonder if enough time has passed. This is really the answer just from a writer's perspective. I wondered, you know, the Iraq War is such a hot, polarizing topic, and it fractured American politics for years and years. And I think when I go out and talk about the book, I'm expecting to have a lot of audience members just relitigate the war. And, you know, there's a lot of pain. A lot of costs were paid for this war. But my hope was, I don't know if it's right, but my hope was, you know, maybe enough time has passed. 20 years is a long time. People still have a living memory of the war, and so they know it's important. But maybe enough time has passed that we can reflect in a different way. We can enlarge our sense of what this was really all about and create some space to think again about Saddam Hussein, who doesn't, you know, he's not rehabilitated in the book by no means. I'm trying to make clear what a war criminal he was, how many lives he took through his actions. But at the same time, to get beyond the cartoon figure, who was part of the reason that we misunderstood was that we didn't make any effort to see the world from his perspective.
When you were doing research and going back through your old articles, did you see in your writing coverage then some things that now, looking back with the 20 years and the reflection and the space that you've got, that you then recognized in your coverage then, like, oh, I was so in it then, or I was so influenced by XYZ thing happening that I covered it this way in a way that now, 20 years on, I think I probably would, like, if I had the space that I had now or the distance that I had now, then I would have covered it differently.
It's a really good question. I mean, the Iraq War was not my like core subject. So I think if you asked me that question about, you know, Sri Lanka or Kashmir or other things that I was really all over, over months and years, I could readily answer it. I think in the case of this book's subject, when I look back at the articles I wrote that left me kind of dissatisfied, and I pulled them out of the archives and reread them. I'm sure no one else has done so for an awfully long time. I mean, it's like, okay, you're like pointing in the right direction, but you're not really sourcing this the right way. You're not really asking the bigger questions. You're just in the moment. It's like the way you said it. The news coverage, just it allows you to skim across the surface of certain kinds of sourcing. And you just don't have the time and space to say, well, what else is there? What are the other ways I could think about this? Or how could I sit down with people who really know what happened and have a slow conversation with them rather than, you know, rushing through the 60 minutes that it can.
Do you have a specific example of something that you remember reading in prepping for this book? And they said, ugh, where?
Well,
what
I
is
mean,
this?
I, I did a, well, it wasn't quite as bad as that, but I did it, but it was still like a, I did what was for the newspaper, and I, you know, it was, nobody else was writing about this at the time. So it was kind of like the definitive take on what we know 6 months after the invasion about why Saddam didn't have WMD from former generals who have now surrendered and who are not being held in captivity. So these aren't prison interviews, but, you know, they're available to tell like what they understood about it. And like they had fancy titles and they were credible generals and they had their own theories about why Saddam had done things the way they did. And I built the story around those interviews. Is, you know, man, solid journalism. But now I look back on it as like, okay, those guys didn't know what the hell was going on either.
Right.
That's kind of the point. And,
right.
And you know, how could I have looked a little bit more widely for perspectives rather than just being enamored of my own scoop of getting to these generals.
Right.
Okay, this is actually going to lead me to the next topic. So I'm going to put a pin in this. But before that, I just wanted to give you a compliment on one of the things that I'm really enjoying reading this book. You pointed out how you tied in everything around characters. The interesting art of journalism is, and journalism is such a vague, all-encompassing umbrella term sometimes, and it shows you how much, because it could include what you just described as just getting the scoop and being able to get the access to the right person, getting the right quote, and, you know, that's your achievement. And on the other hand, it can be putting together deep, complicated, contradictory narratives and that pose big questions about how we think of ourselves as a world, as a society, how we engage in foreign affairs, and then find specific, crazy, colorful characters to tell it through. It's just stunning to me how with every character that you bring in, it would not just be, okay, here's a narrative device in order to make the point. You're going the extra step into understanding who they are, even if it's a character that would appear only for a half a chapter. Specifically, I made a note to remember William Eagleton because I just love the fact that he's this, I guess, State Department type with an Arabist bent who is obsessed with Kurdish rugs. And I just like that detail of being obsessed with Kurdish rugs. Like, tell me, like, I know who this person is now. I know him. I know how he sees the world when he goes to Iraq and imagines himself the imperialist going to the Great Orient in order to understand the locals better and being enamored with a local culture. I could see him. And I love that. Those details are not just fun. They reveal so much about how those flaws of personalities and problems of perceptions end up, you know, defining the course of history. Mm-hmm. All those minor characters, all those minor interests and flawed perceptions come together to create whatever ends up being like a devastating war, for instance. Like, how do you know when you have enough? How do you know this character is, that's a little two-dimensional. I need more. I can't justify writing this chapter yet.
Yeah. No, it's a good question. I'm not always right about that, but you do have a feeling from experience about when you may have enough. But I often find with characters in particular, especially living characters who I've interviewed, like Jafar Diaz-Jafar, who is sort of the Robert Oppenheimer of the Iraqi nuclear program. He's on the first sentence of the first page of the narrative, and I try to at intervals, bring him all the way through to the end. And I wanted an Iraqi character who was not Saddam Hussein, who didn't have blood on his hands, at least not directly, and who was, you know, he would complicate American expectations of what an Iraqi would be like. And I met him in Dubai and I spent a long period of time with him. And he had written a memoir in Arabic, which I, you know, had translated. But I then found when I was starting to write that I needed more. I started a correspondence with him. Fortunately, COVID, everybody had a lot of time on their hands. So I was starting to write back and forth. And I literally started out with the kinds of things that drive sources crazy sometimes, which is like, okay, on that morning, like, what was your breakfast routine? And you got in a car. What, do you remember what make and model it was? Did you drive it yourself or did you have a chauffeur? what kind, do you remember what brand of tea you drank before you left? And, you know, I now have this huge record of correspondence with him about that stuff, both originally when I was trying to write, but then also the fact checker did the same thing. And, you know, I don't know. I try not to. One thing about writing, I'm still working at trying to get better, but I think my experience of working at The New Yorker in particular did a good job of bringing me to a self-edit about detail. Like, detail for its own sake can feel like performative, and it actually gets in the way of a direct emotional experience with the writing. And so you have to follow your gut, but you're looking for some kind of Goldilocks use of detail, like the right balance. And, you know, I love that you remember the Kurdish rugs, because to me, like, all I needed was that. I didn't need to go much more. And sometimes you just, there's something that rings the bell for you and you feel like you can use it and move on. But if you have a character like Jafar, who is going to play a major role across the whole arc of the book, you have to decide, like, when and how you're going to try to keep deepening engagement with him. And sometimes, like, he's a very proud person. I think in the end, he's kind of elusive as to why he made the decisions he did. But I also feel like you certainly understand him as a human being. I hope people have the time for that now after all this, all of this disruption and suffering that the war has caused, to go back and actually see the people who were present at its creation.
How do you think the, this is a bit of a meta question before we dive into the details. I keep postponing the getting into it, but, I wonder just what you said was kind of interesting to me. Now that people can go back and start looking at the war, what's the difference between how the, let's say, the Western and intelligentsia is approaching revisiting that period and people in Iraq? There are efforts of revision on both sides, right?
It's a great question. I don't feel that I know the answer adequately, but part of the answer is definitely that the war itself has so disrupted the space in which, and the civil wars that followed the U.S. invasion, that were unleashed by the U.S. invasion, it's so disrupted the space where scholarship of that kind would take place without being an instrument of sectarian competition or intra-ethnic competition. So, you know, the big story in Iraq is still the Sunni-Shia conflict that Saddam's reign suppressed but didn't by any means end or eliminate. And so when you tell the story of the U.S. intervention and its aftermath in Iraq today, it's pretty hard to get away from the core bloodshed and search for accommodation that has taken place in this three-sided kind of conflict among the principal communities of the country. And so I think, you know, there are definitely historians, for example, Kurdish historians, who look at the price their community paid through Saddam's use of chemical weapons at places like Halabja, and just kind of documenting their own experience of being victimized by Saddam. Like, that is a fairly stable history, and it's accessible in kind of peer-reviewed Western scholarship and so forth. But the core story, the Baghdad story, is so disrupted by the unfinished conflict and, you know, the presence of Iranian expansionism inside Iraq and so forth. I mean, it's just a quick microcosm of that. The tapes, the Saddam tapes that we've talked about, they became a subject of debate in Western scholarship. They are a kind of war booty. And there were concerns that it was unethical to just use them, you know, as in such. And there was a movement to give them back to the Iraqi government. And at one point, circa 2010, 11, something like that, the Iraqis formally asked the Obama administration, can we have this stuff back?
Wow.
And the Obama administration returned it. I mean, they returned copies. They didn't, I think it's digital. So, but anyway, they did give it back. they called no attention to what they'd done. They did it in secret. And the materials that the Iraqis received, far from resting in a library where Iraqi scholars can start to make sense of it for themselves, they've never been seen again because they're almost too dangerous in the live sectarian conflict that continues to roil Iraq.
Wow. I am curious about the lawsuit that you filed in partnership with an organization to get access to them. Is that something you'd done before? Had you sued for information before, or was this a new journey?
It was a new journey. I mean, you know, the Freedom of Information Act is a great opportunity for journalism, but it's also a broken regime. And in the past, with book projects, I've filed FOIA requests, and I've had some success in getting materials that helped advance the reporting for the book, but it often has taken years to get anything back. And I always felt that it was a little bit like throwing a message in a bottle and just mm-hmm. seeing if something came back onto my island. And
right.
this time I was determined to be more purposeful. And the first question was, where are these materials? And so I had to do some reporting to figure out, like, where did they physically reside inside the Pentagon? And I got it down to like the exact office, and they're on these hard drives, and this person is in charge of them, and they're in a safe. And so then I wrote to the Pentagon before filing the lawsuit and said, gee whiz, you know, you really should let this stuff go. And they wrote back and said, yes, we agree, but it's complicated. And then I never really heard from them again. And so at a certain point, with advice from the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press, they specialize in supporting investigative reporting. And the Freedom of Information Act is one of the areas where they're particularly effective, and they're pro bono. You know, if they take you on, they just support you and for free. And so I talked to them and explained the situation. They said, you know, you should win this case. This is not as hard as some of them because you know exactly where this stuff is, and it's not technically classified because foreign government material can't be classified as U.S. secrets because it wasn't our stuff. Like, now it can be sensitive, it can be confidential, you can keep it out of the public domain for different reasons, but that also was a factor in thinking, you know what, this is going to work. So I went through the process that they recommend you go through. I filed a FOIA request. I let the clock run. I wrote back to them and said, hey, I haven't heard from you. And they said, hey, we know we're past deadline. And then I wrote and said, hey, I may sue you if you don't respond soon. And they said, okay, we hear you. And nothing happened. And then eventually we just sued. And what they had advised me is what unfolded, which is if you have the right kind of lawyers and you file the right kind of suit, they have to come to terms with you pretty quickly. So within 2-3 months after the suit was filed, they were back to us with a settlement proposal. And it really went pretty quickly from there.
And then what, it like shows up on your doorstep in a basket?
They gave it to my lawyer on a thumb drive, and then he sent it to me, and then I plugged it into my computer and said, wow, this is amazing.
That must have been a fun day.
Yes.
Let's talk about Saddam at last. Let me see if I can like actually read my notes. So I think one of the most interesting thing about this book as a thesis, it's this conflict of perceptions between how Saddam understood his role in the world or the international dynamics around him and how the U.S. did. So let's start with I'm going to try and talk about Saddam's conspiracy mindset, and then we'll try to talk about America and its difficulty in understanding the Middle East through different phases. But starting with Saddam, the most consistent thing that you're talking about in the book is he believed his own conspiracies, right? He viewed the world as, you know, run by the CIA in collaboration with the Zionists and in direct opposition to his regime, you know, on an almost personal level, on a personal or cosmic level opposed to him.
Yes.
According to you, he was not pretending to be this, you know, psychotic, paranoid, schizophrenic leader just to create and, you know, to destabilize negotiations and to be the madman in game theory. No, he really believed that if he's bluffing about having WMDs, then the CIA must already know this because the CIA knows everything.
Yes, he really believed these things, and it was it took a while of sitting still with his voice on these transcripts to understand how that played out for him. The easiest place to start, I think, is that like a lot of leaders in the Middle East and elsewhere, he believed the CIA was kind of all-knowing and that it was constantly conspiring against him and in the region. And he therefore believed that the CIA knew that he didn't have WMD and that all of this accusation and kind of noise that they were fomenting against him, that it was all just a game, that it was just an excuse to get rid of him. And so why should he play their game by cooperating with these phony inspections when they knew all along that he didn't have it? And they were just inventing a pretense for war. And now that conviction, so the idea that the CIA was capable of getting a big analytical question like whether or not he had WMD wrong, this wasn't part of his worldview. Like they know what's going on. But it also goes back to his sense of who his enemies were and how he should maneuver to survive in power. So you're right. He saw himself surrounded by a three-part sleepless conspiracy against him. The United States, Israel, and Iran, even revolutionary Iran, Ayatollah Khomeini's Iran, he regarded as a partner of Israel and the United States. Now, where did he get this idea? Well, Iran-Contra in 1986, when he was in the middle of an existential war with Iran, which he had started, you know, in fact, Israel drew the Reagan administration into a brief cooperation with Ayatollah Khomeini's regime. The American motivation was trying to get some hostages freed. The Israelis were seeking to play a long game with Iran and still hopeful that somehow this revolution wouldn't become as radical as and embedded as it did. And when that was exposed, like Saddam was like, the tapes after it was exposed are actually very funny, at least if you're saturated in the material as I was. It's like he gets all of his comrades together when this is announced, the Iran-Contra conspiracy. He says, see, I told you all along. I mean, how many times do I have to tell you? This is how the world works. He was the least surprised leader in a shocked world when Iran-Contra was revealed. And again, the idea that Iran-Contra represented a strain of harebrained incompetence in American foreign policy that recurs from time to time, but not really part of his worldview. And what's so interesting in the tapes is that many years later, when he's agitated about the Americans, he'll refer back to Iran-Contra long after everybody else has kind of forgotten about it as a weird cul-de-sac episode in foreign policy. And he's like, yes, see, because that's still what's going on, my friends. That's still what's going on. He believed it.
Was it with, I don't remember if it was with Iran or Kuwait, again, because he makes the assumption that the CIA is so involved with everything and is aware of every decision. I think he said at some point in his imprisonment, then, well, if the U.S. didn't want me to invade, why didn't they say so?
Right. Yes, exactly. And this was, I mean, that's a little bit, it is hilarious that he said that. And clearly, when you have the benefit of hindsight, you can see that the United States missed an opportunity to deter him clearly. But in fairness to the Bush administration, the George H.W. Bush administration, I mean, he lied through his teeth repeatedly, not just to the Bush administration, but to all of his Arab allies and about what he intended to do. And
Saddam did.
Yeah.
Right. And which is why, he thought that I'm lying. But of course, they know that I'm lying because the CIA is omniscient.
Exactly. Yeah. That's very, very well Yes, now you're inside the rabbit hole here. you have entered. And yeah, that's kind of how it went. But the Bush administration was also imprisoned by its own kind of automatic pilot idea that even though Saddam was a terrible strongman who gassed his own people and gassed the Iranians and had all of these conspiracy theories about the Middle East and was, you know, an anti-Semite's anti-Semite and had no vision of a Middle East with Israel in it, even after, you know, Madrid, even after Oslo, he was just, you know, the last rejectionist. And so despite all of that, the Bush administration thought, maybe we can do business with this guy. I mean, he's not as bad as Ayatollah Khomeini, so maybe we can do business with him. And that was the attitude they brought to this eve of the Kuwait war, when they might have said to him clearly, if you're seriously thinking about invading Kuwait, we will make you pay such a high price that you will conclude that it wasn't worth it. So please don't even think about it. There, a deterrence like message like that, although it would have been difficult to deliver credibly, it still probably would have gotten his attention. You look at the transcripts of all the meetings he had with American diplomats where he was basically fooling them into believing that he was still thinking about his options and so forth. He was waiting for the signal. He was asking, like, how far would you go if I did this? You know, there's some subtle moments where it kind of went right over the heads of everybody in the room. But with hindsight, you can see that he was probing and we never took him up on this question.
And some of them less subtle than others, right? He, if I remember correctly, he moves forces towards Kuwait, but the Bush administration, Bush senior administration thinks that, well, surely that's just part of the bluff, right? This is just to get better leverage on Kuwait.
And that's right. And
so motivated reasoning is huge.
Motivated reasoning is huge. And also bad advice from trusted Arab allies. Like we, you know, Saddam, puzzled us. We did have a lot of contact with him in the 80s and like in the 90s, but he was still hard to read and he would rant on about all of these conspiracies and American diplomats would sometimes walk away shaking their heads. But, you know, King Fahd of Saudi Arabia, Hosni Mubarak of Egypt, and especially King Hussein of Jordan, they had a lot of contact with Saddam of a different quality. And they were sort of our access agents to what was Saddam really thinking here. And they all advised in the run-up to the invasion, don't take him seriously. This is just a bluff. He's putting the arm on. He wants to get paid. There was a big dispute about tens of billions of dollars in loans that he wanted converted into credits. So all of this is just his style of negotiating. See all those tanks he's rolling down towards the border with Kuwait? We've been here before. He always does this. And then it's a bluff and someone will pay him and he'll back off. And they were just wrong. And, you know, it was HW's strength as a president that he actually picked up the phone and talked to other leaders all the time and had a subtle sense of who was who and what they thought, and that he took advice. And this time he took all this advice from these very well-positioned allies. And it just turned out that they were wrong. So sometimes that happens.
This really touches why I find this book so thought-provoking. You almost get to be super reductive about this. You get two models of foreign affairs or international relations. In one, you have the American model, or the way the American State Department likes to think of itself as this, you know, this heir to the British Empire, super sophisticated, being able to understand the subtleties of different regions and different cultures and thread the needle perfectly so that their interests are preserved, which does, to be fair, require sometimes making shady deals with bad actors or compromising your bigger ethical stance in order to create some regional stability. And, you know, we talked about the Iran-Contra, for instance. You can follow the logic that led to, and you do actually in the book, you can follow the logic very charitably that leads to the Iran-Contra scandal in how the American foreign establishment is trying to reconcile interests with Iran, trying to get hostages released, create stability, or promote their interests in South America. Between all of that, they're bundling a lot of interests together while believing in their own power to perfect balance those subtle choices and marginally get a better, more stable world. So even if you're generous, you don't need to be Chomskyite and see everything as a cynical American conspiracy, but just overconfident policymaking around the world and a sense of their own ability to understand complexity. And on the other hand, you get Saddam's version, which is just a totalitarian worldview. The world revolves around me. I see it more clearly than everyone because I see the conspiracy. It's the red-pilled version of foreign policy. We exist in this cosmic struggle, and I understand it. And as with every conspiracy theory, every once in a while you get something right, right? And the one time you get something right, you feel even more confident and the people around you feel more assured in your own ability to see things clearly. And then when those two worldviews clash, you get the madness of Saddam boasting about WMDs that he doesn't have, believing that surely they know that I don't have it because they know everything. And America being overly cautious, trying to over-engineer world policy, thinking, well, we can't take that risk. We need to go to war.
Yeah, no, that's very well summarized. Very well summarized. I think the only kind of addition I would make is that if you sit and read the raw tapes, the way that you describe Saddam is exactly right. But from paragraph to paragraph in his monologues, he is incredibly shrewd sometimes about power. Because after all, he acquired it in a very rough situation. He grew up as a kind of an assassin and a gunman. But he doesn't hold power just because he, you know, throws people in jail and tortures them and kills anybody who crosses him. He's also charismatic and he's shrewd and he can see people in multiple dimensions. And sometimes he'll just, thinking aloud, he'll forecast the future with such prescience about the United States and how it's going to, you know, sort of operate in the Middle East over the next 10 or 20 years or what the next phase of geopolitics looks like. And you're like, wow, this guy, you know, and it wasn't just the stopped clock being right twice a day. It was like he really did think about power in a sophisticated way, the way a mafia don would, because you got to, you know, you sit with your back to the wall in the restaurant because you know people are coming after you, but you can't just, you know, use violence to stay alive. You've got to see around corners. And he could do that. But then he also, in the very next paragraph, he would be full of such nonsense and confusion through the same that it's, you know, it was very hard to separate one side of his brain from the other.
Right. And you have the flip side of that with the American establishment, where all the sophistication and attempt at delicate diplomacy leads to such absurd assumptions sometimes that can completely miss the gun by making over-elaborate, and we see it even today, by making over-elaborate assumptions about the interests of leaders or how they see the world, rather than saying, no, he is what he is. You can see it if you just look at it without layers of statescraft or over-interpretation.
I ended up sort of two minds about this, and it wasn't necessary for me to resolve it in the book, but I still feel uncertain about it. As you know, when you think about what should the United States do in circumstances like this, because on the one hand, it's clear that we didn't make an adequate effort to see the world from behind his eyes, and that certainly was within our capability if we had maintained contact with him, if we had gotten past the kind of cartoon reductionism of the way we characterize him. We might have understood that he was aging, that he had become obsessed with writing novels, that he wasn't, you know, likely to start another war next week. So on the one hand, you would wish for us to be better at turning the camera around in a complicated world and taking people at face value and trying to listen and understand who they are, even if they're, you know, monsters, because they are ultimately decision makers and they have a human complexity about them. So that's on the one hand. On the other hand, I think we're so bad at that at the end of the day, even though you would wish for it to take place more often, that maybe the simplest way is to just write an algorithm, you know, or in classic international relations and defense doctrine. You know, the one of the fundamentals is don't worry about your enemy's intentions. Just look at their capabilities. And if they're capable of doing something that you don't want them to do, tell them not to do it credibly, and maybe they won't. And if they do it, punish them for it.
Right.
You know, and like that, like a really 5-sentence algorithm, and stop trying to make it complicated because you're terrible at it. You're, in fact, they're much better at that than you are.
Right. And I think that's the point. That's the point, because the madness happens on the US side because of the combination of being really bad at projecting what people are going to do or where other leaders' minds are at, combined with overconfidence in their ability to do just that.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. Yes.
But I also am not convinced that anybody is able to do that. The reason that Saddam is successful when he is successful is because he relied on, doesn't matter if my metaphysics of the world is right or wrong, I understand basic power relations and I know how to play them.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
I feel like this is a good place to pivot to the conflict in Israel, actually, because I think we're talking a bit about, you know, what should the U.S. have done then? The U.S. is in an interesting position right now where it kind of is an influential actor potentially in what's happening in Gaza. The idea of understanding intentions versus capabilities of actors, I think, is also relevant. So, Adam, you okay with me transitioning us to Israel, or did you have one last thing about?
No, I will combine those two questions as kind of like building up, I guess, to Israel, because I wanted to ask you to hear how you would characterize the following. Reading the book, I feel like you can see different phases of how the U.S. misunderstands the Middle East, specifically focusing on Iraq. But I think broadly, you can see how the shifts of policy inform different behaviors. And you can almost see it specifically with Rumsfeld and the journey that Rumsfeld undergoes in relation to Saddam. But I wanted to hear how you see the journey that the U.S. goes in its perception of its role in the Middle East.
Well, I mean, not to deliver a potted history, but I think if you take the big picture of where the U.S. Priorities were in the Middle East around the time that Saddam became president of Iraq, so say 79, second oil embargo after the Yom Kippur War and so forth, you would say that American policy was driven by two things, the alliance with Israel and the protection of the oil industry and the oil shipping out of the Gulf, under the rationale that oil was fundamental to the Western economy and a stable price and stable access was basic to American security and prosperity, as well as European security and prosperity. So that's why we were going to make sure the shipping lanes stayed open. So oil and Israel. Now, if you ask the question today, how relevant are those two factors in the American engagement in the Middle East, even when, you know, successive presidents have said, we're done with the Middle East, we're pivoting to Asia. Well, yeah, the Middle East isn't done with you. So obviously it's still sucking up a lot of American foreign policy attention and potential. So you would say, well, Israel is obviously still basic to America's place in the Middle East. This alliance is so fundamental and has been around for so long. And yes, it has become troubled over the last 10 years because of the governments in Israel and Washington diverging and kind of messing around in each other's politics, and because of the settler movement and all kinds of other things that you could break down. But the alliance is still there, and you see that in Biden's decision-making. Again, and this is fundamental to his own view of America in the Middle East, going all the way back to his Senate Foreign Relations days. So that's still there. On the oil side, it's interesting because that's a little closer to where Iraq is. You would think that in the transition to a post-fossil fuel world, that oil and gas would matter less to the United States. And it does, because we're now producers of oil to the extent that we need it. We are net exporters a lot of the time these days. We have our own, you know, energy future on our continent. We're less dependent. Yes, the world economy is still dependent on oil, but is that really our business? Maybe not so much anymore as we look to a post-fossil fuel future. But then you get something like the Russian invasion of Ukraine and their attempt to basically starve Europe into submission by cutting off natural gas supplies. How does Europe survive this threat from Russia? They run down to Qatar. They cut deals for liquid natural gas for the next 10 or 20 years. They beat the Russians at their own game. But now all these ships have to go back through the Persian Gulf to Europe to LNG terminals. And that means that we're still back as the world's policemen protecting these same waterways and shooting at Houthis about access to the Red Sea Canal. And yeah, we can say it's about shipping in general, but no, it's about the energy economy and its centrality to the world economy, and the fact that it still flows out of this very small set of waterways that are highly contested by the people who live alongside them.
Given your insight into both the minds of the type of people who develop state policy and how those institutions move, the sclerosis of those institutions, how much do you think the persisting prominence of Gulf oil is a reflective goal, or is it just kind of a residual ossified habit that clicks in whenever there is conflict in the region that has not really been revisited?
I think it's probably more a residual ossified habit than a reflective policy. But because there is so much substantive requirements from important allies to keep this energy flowing, and because we do see a stake in the Russian invasion of Ukraine, then it's not completely, you know, autopilot. I was struck in the research. There was an Erebus diplomat named David Newsom, who's now passed, but he was seen as one of the great American diplomats of his generation in the Middle East. And he was on a kind of oral history panel. And I think they were talking about the kind of CIA partnership with Saddam during the 1980s and how they allowed it to continue even as he gassed the Kurds and gassed the Iranians and, you know, broke all the norms in the world around the use of chemical weapons. And he sort of paused during the conversation and he says something like, you know, what I've learned is that the hardest thing for the American government to do is to come to terms with a failed policy. It's just so difficult to break the momentum because you always think there's just a little tweak. And if we just do it a little bit different, 6 months from now, we'll fix it. And plus people change positions. So everybody comes in and says, well, the last guys, they probably weren't as good as I'm going to be in fixing this. And so there's just such resistance to coming to terms. Look at, you know, something like the war in Afghanistan and how hard it was to rip the Band-Aid off and decide to leave. And of course, we did it so horribly and decided in such a terrible way. But even the fact that the decision to leave was so badly handled across multiple years and two presidencies is just an indication about how hard it is to come to terms with something that has accumulated in the system and that is, you know, just hard to confront.
I'm just kind of interested because you brought it up in the context of coming to terms with failed policy. Just from your hunch and looking at the region, this is a stupid question and feel free not to answer it, but if you look at the mistake of starting the war, the preservation of the occupation in Afghanistan, and the botched withdrawal, which do you think is the worst?
Well, I think the one that was the most avoidable was the bad withdrawal. I think there were credible other ways to leave that wouldn't have betrayed so many Afghans who drank the Kool-Aid for so long and left so many Afghans. Maybe the result would have been the same, but you can't say that we made anything like our best effort to get out with respect for all the Afghans we had partnered with and persuaded to, you know, that they had a different future after many years of war that they didn't start because, you know, it all started with outside invasion. So that's my answer.
So yeah, that's how I think. I think Vanessa is going to take us into talking about media in a second. I'll pivot through Israel. You're talking about the consistency of American policy towards Israel. How do you explain it? Like, what is the core of that relationship? What is the interdependence? Is it just about having a Western outpost in an oil rich region, or is there something else?
Well, I mean, some of it is about the history of the birth of the state of Israel and the American sort of commitment to that project, along with other countries.
Although the coldest relations between Israel and the U.S. were the first 10 years of its existence.
Yes, that's true. But as Israel became the most successful state in its neighborhood and was allied with the United States during the Cold War, that cemented the willingness of the United States to deal with Israeli departures from American preferences, to recognize that Israel was always going to act independently on the basis of its own sense of where its security lay, and that we were going to have a lot of disagreements. And for a long time, the idea that that was reconcilable with a sovereign and dignified future for the Palestinian people drew American administrations one after another into the project of just kind of stitching those two things together, particularly after the Cold War ended and the rationale for kind of security first waned, and the Israelis and Palestinians on their own without American brokers found a path to the initial kind of envisioning of a two-state solution. Then that occupied 20 years of successive efforts to try to, you know, that was the way this was going to stabilize. And when that failed, again, you know, we're still slow to recognize that the failure of this project, and it's not very helpful to keep talking about, well, you got to keep trying. I mean, yes, it's true. All the other solutions are worse, but this, you know, the Abraham Accords and the attempt to try to stabilize Israel's presence in the Middle East and the U.S. role through a completely different methodology was almost done, you know, through the back door, because it's just so complicated to come to terms with what doesn't work in the relationship. And I think, you know, the Obama administration was the time when high-level cabinet officers started having unemotional and honest conversations about, you know what, that maybe this relationship isn't working for us. Like, they really treat us like crap sometimes. And the president was very frustrated. And, you know, Bob Gates, his Secretary of Defense, was like, this is a one-way relationship. We give, and they don't give us. And this was talking about Netanyahu and the way, you know, Netanyahu had stepped into American party politics. But, you know, it's interesting in the light of current events that in those arguments that we now know about through memoirs and other things that weren't really evident at the time, Biden was the one who was always on the side of, nope, this is a bedrock commitment of the United States. And he really believes it through and through. And at this stage in his life, he's not going to change his mind. And so that explains a lot of what we've seen unfold since October 7th, I think.
So it sounds like then there has been some back channel or behind the scenes questioning of the relationship, but the public stance, at least on from the Biden administration, at least has been fairly steadfastly supportive. But the coverage, the way that people are talking about the conflict, and I have not been covering, this is not my beat, but it seems like the way that people are covering it feels differently than in the past. And you've written about Gaza and the situation there for a few years. I read one of your articles, I think in 2021, where you said something along the lines of, like, let's not mistake what looks like stability for peace, something along those lines. It seemed like you were aware something like October 7th might have happened. I don't know to what extent you were shocked or not shocked by what did happen. But, well, I guess, first of all, do you see a significant difference in the way that media is covering this conflict than it has in the past?
Yeah, I think there is a shift, but it probably just reflects some fault lines in America that are part of our media because the media reflects society. And I think one is generational. I think a lot of young journalists in newsrooms who think freely and independently about what they see in the conflict and who may have developed views, you know, as they came of age in college or down other channels, like they have a view about the priorities of American foreign policy and coverage that is different from many of the older editors. And you see this arise in petitions and dialogue in newsrooms about, you know, what should be the language we use, what should be the framing, what should be the priorities and so forth. And I think a lot of editors of my generation were surprised and a little bit challenged by that. But I think it's the kind of thing that has happened before in newsrooms along kind of generational lines. And I'd like to think that overall it's healthy because, you know, you want young journalists to think for themselves as long as you can continue to maintain your commitment to journalism values together. And I think the second fault line, maybe a little bit more familiar going back through the Obama years, is just the way the alliance between the United States and Israel has become weaponized in both countries' domestic politics, which in both cases are highly polarized, both in Israel and in the United States. And so that, you know, with Netanyahu going over Obama's head and walking before a Republican-led Congress and saying, you know, I'm appealing over the head of the President of the United States to tell you, you know, that we should not be negotiating with Iran to prevent nuclear proliferation. Like that level of a kind of loss of decorum in the relationship was unprecedented. And it opened up both kind of assumptions and bitterness and a sense also of how the game should be played that has, you know, continued. And it was only the sheer shock of October 7th and the recognition that this was an unprecedented event in the life of Israel and that, you know, that there was a sort of game-changing aspect of the violence that and the success of the attack that muted that for a little while. But once the Israeli counterattack began, that sense of solidarity with the Israeli experience yielded to these, you know, sort of fault lines being more exposed. And that continues today.
Going to the first fault line you pointed out, the generational, I've produced recently an interview with for The Dispatch with A.G. Sulzberger following his essay for the Columbia Review of Journalism, specifically about how the idea of objectivity has shifted in newsrooms.
Yes.
How do you, I'm assuming that you're aware of that discourse. How do you think about this tendency in at least the way that he diagnoses it as of increasing political involvement or an expectation of your role as a journalist to be much more akin to activism or political / culture warfare than the attempt to tell a story and cover it more independently? I would actually have taken issue with you saying that the new generation comes in with more independent thinking, but we'll leave that aside. Yeah.
Well, I would say two things. First, on the never-ending debate about objectivity itself, my own take remains what it was when this first started, you know, maybe when you guys were in J school, which is that objectivity, I can see is a terrible word. It's not really a human word. It doesn't describe human beings. But what it's intended to say is something that I think remains absolutely fundamental to good journalism, which is it's intended to describe fairness, completeness, intellectual honesty, a sense of being led by evidence, not starting out with a hypothesis and then just filling in evidence to support what you already believe. It's about the scientific method. That is the claim that journalism has to professionalism. It's part of the claim that journalism has to a distinctive status under our Constitution. If it's just another set of voices in polarized, largely opinion-driven, predetermined political argument, then why should courts protect you when you say, I can't tell you who told me this important fact that I've now brought before the world? You know, you've got to have a theory of evidence-led work to live up to the promise and the actual engineering of the First Amendment in our society. So that's about the kind of technical part of objectivity. In terms of the politicization of journalism, I mean, I think we have to accept, and I certainly don't think that it's terrible. It's like accepting the weather. There's nothing you can really do about it. So we now have moved from an era of, you know, dominant establishment journalism to an era of many journalisms. And that is much more like what other open societies look like. I mean, over here, you have newspapers that have long been clearly identified for their ideological perspective or even their party affiliation. In continental Europe, same thing. Some of those papers still produce, you know, tremendous evidence-led reporting that surprises and reveals. But I prefer our somewhat technocratic approach to you know, being fair and complete and really trying to be scientific about the way you do your work. But it's not surprising that with the shattering of the business models of dominant network television and newspapers, that we've ended up in a much more fractious and diverse environment where newsrooms define themselves by very different creeds. There was briefly a newsroom called Fusion,
and there were a lot of, like, at like the career fair for us, there were a lot of places that no longer exist.
This one had a lot of money. I think it was partly ABC News and partly Univision. Their general counsel, they were a very young newsroom. They were like almost everybody was in their 20s, and they had a newsroom in like the Lower East Side that looked like a Silicon Valley startup place with a garage door and a lot of ping pong tables. And their general counsel invited me down to talk to them because he was scared to death that none of them were, you know, that they were going to get themselves sued because none of them had had proper training or any even a conversation about some of the things we're talking about. So I came down not to give them a talk, but just to answer their questions. But before we started, I said, so like, how do you guys define yourself? What is your mission? And they said, well, our journalism is directed to do two things. One is to reflect and promote a multicultural society in America that is inclusive and honest about what America really is. And the second principle is the promotion of legalization of marijuana. I said, okay. So I said, that opens a good door. Like, let's talk about your coverage of Colorado or the state of Washington. So if you are a newsroom that believes in the promotion of the legalization of marijuana and you get out on the ground in Colorado and you see that the implementation of this goal has a bunch of flaws, like the licensing regime is wrong, or, you know, there's all kinds of public health things that you didn't anticipate that are happening. So what's your attitude? Are you going to be the first to tell the hard truths about this thing you believe in? Or are you going to kind of skate by it, let it, you know, cut corners and not really, or you know, worse, underplay it or deny that it's even happening? Because that's the difference between journalism and some other kind of strategic communications. I don't mind that you're for the legalization of marijuana, but I just want you to cover it honestly. So
this is about our original connection. The existence of J schools is something that we've been struggling with on this pod and trying to understand how we feel about this. Are J schools actually a way to get into the to acquire skills to be a journalist, or are they a membership card into the American elite in order to find a job at a dying industry?
Yeah, well, it's certainly the employment side of the equation that buoyed J schools for a long time, you know, has been badly disrupted. And I think it's fair to ask, is the equation, you know, worth it for me or for, you know, it clearly is still, it still works for some, but I wouldn't argue that it's the way it was even in 2006 or 2008. I mean, it's changed very rapidly. When I was dean, I took solace in the fact that if you were young and motivated and you paid attention to your one-year course, when you came out, you would be highly sought after, generally speaking, because the business still needed, and actually desperately needed, new perspectives and people who were comfortable with telling stories in lots of different ways at the same time, and but who were still basically able to recognize a story, to report and think and write. And everybody I ever asked when I was dean, like, what are you looking for in our graduates? Do you want more, you know, audio skills? Do you want more social media skills? They all said, just send me someone who can think and write and report and recognize a story, because that's what I can't do myself. I can't train people to do that. You know, no matter how much time it goes on, every institution that is really serious about reporting needs journalists. That's what they need. They need people who are interested in journalism. And the rest, you know, over the course of a career, people can reinvent themselves with their skills lots of different ways, as long as they're passionate about the work itself and honest about how it gets done.
Well, you've been extra generous with your time, but maybe sometime I'll meet you over wine and I will argue with you over this point. But so thank you so much, former Dean Steve Cole.
Yes, thank you.